Welcome to the CSIS Cogitasia podcast, where we think deeply and reflect on policy in Asia. I'm your host, Colm Quinn. This week, we talk about the rags-to-riches story of the National League for Democracy, or NLD, in Myanmar, or Burma. In November 2015, the NLD, led by Nobel Peace Prize winner Aung San Suu Kyi, trounced the ruling military-backed opposition party in general elections. Following the inauguration on the 1st of this month, Suu Kyi and the NLD now must govern for the first time. Having won the executive and holding majorities in both houses of parliament, the NLD must confront massive challenges that will shape Myanmar's future. It's worth remembering that Aung San Suu Kyi and her party have come a long way to achieve this, from house arrest to head of government in under 30 years.
So in 1988, there's an uprising after food prices rise and various other problems in response to the military junta's mismanagement. And at that point, Aung San Suu Kyi returns to then Burma, Myanmar, to take care of her mother. But these uprisings are happening, and she then forms, after that, the National League for Democracy. They win an election in 1990, overwhelmingly, but aren't allowed to take office. And really, most of the members are in prison, in and out of prison. Some go overseas. And it really takes till the government, the junta, decides in 2010 to launch reforms. 2012 has by-elections and allows some members, allows 45 by-elections in which the National League for Democracy wins 43, Aung San Suu Kyi wins. And then that leads up to the elections we've just had. So in a sense, it is an amazing story of how a military decides to do reforms and lets the opposition win. We don't know exactly how well they'll let them govern, but it is a pretty amazing tale.
That was Murray Hebert, Deputy Director and Senior Advisor with the Chair for Southeast Asia Studies at CSIS. As CSIS Associate Fellow Fung Nguyen says, Myanmar's struggle for self-rule has been a long time coming.
I think it's been a huge change, but not just for Aung San Suu Kyi or for her party, the National League for Democracy. If you recall, when she came back to Burma in 1988 and when she became the face of the pro-democracy movement, she labeled the movement as the second struggle for independence for the Burmese people. And as you know, the Burmese people had struggled previously for independence from British colonization and after that from exploitation by the Japanese during World War II. So in a way, people came to her because the majority of the Burmese people, they do believe that finding democracy and putting aside military rule is sort of a second struggle for the independence of the country. So it's not just Aung San Suu Kyi, not just her party, but also the people of Burma. They see this as really their country finding a second life.
For the NLD, starting as an activist movement and forming an opposition party has not offered many opportunities to gain experience in governing. Murray Hebert explains.
Well, they just really don't have people who've run very many big things. Some have been former civil servants. Some have been military officers. Back in the day, the president, Htin Kyaw, has been a civil servant. He's an economist. He has some background, but he's basically been a writer and an NLD activist. You know, a lot of these people just really haven't had the experience of running a ministry, trying to introduce reforms, introduce policies, regulations. So it's going to be a real serious challenge for them in a country that has to find peace with its ethnic minorities along its borders with China and Thailand. It has to develop an economy that has a whacked out infrastructure, doesn't have rule of law that's going to entice foreign investors. They have a weak education system. There is just an unending list of challenges they face. And the new leaders are going to have to figure out how to launch, not only run the country, but launch reforms to take the country to new heights.
Meeting expectations for economic growth, both to create jobs and attract investment, is one standout challenge for Myanmar's new leadership, where there's no shortage of improvements to be made.
One of the things they need to deal with is their very weak infrastructure, lack of roads, ports, electricity. Even in Yangon, the economic capital, the biggest city, often electricity goes off. You're staying in a hotel or a big office building. They all have generators. You're going to need rule of law. You're going to need regulations that are going to entice foreign investors. A lot of foreign investors have gone in, particularly from Southeast Asia and China. Japanese and Koreans to some extent, Americans are largely holding back. As you know, the U.S. has had sanctions against this country for a long time. The U.S. has moved to ease the sanctions, but one of the key sanctions that remains is the ban on doing business with somewhere around 150, 200 business guys who a lot of people call cronies of the former junta. There's a specially designated list of people, and these are often, yes, they've had privileges, but they are also among the wealthiest, most, they have capital, they have business know-how, and these are the guys that a foreign investor might want to work with, but a U.S. company is banned from working with them. And so it does hold back investment, and the U.S. is going to have to work with the new government to figure out what it wants to do about that, because the value of U.S. companies going in is not only because they bring capital, others are bringing capital, but they do bring a different culture, not bribing, trying to protect the environment and some of those things, which when President Obama eased the sanctions in 2012, he said one of the reasons we want to do this is to let U.S. companies go in. And right now, it's really very difficult. A few companies like Coca-Cola have done relatively small investments, but the big stuff really isn't happening yet.
Civil-military relations in Myanmar will play a key role in how efforts to reform the economy and improve standards of living turn out. Keep in mind, it's been 6 years since the generals began the process of opening up. We turn back to Fung to discuss whether the relationship is sustainable now that the junta is no longer in power.
I think it's a relationship that has to be sustainable for this democratic transition to go on and be smooth and deliver for Myanmar. After the elections, the military commander-in-chief sat down with Aung San Suu Kyi for 3 times and they discussed the transition. And the commander-in-chief, General Min Aung Hlaing, has been very firm that he will oversee the smooth power handover. So we know that the military, they may have their own interests to protect, but all of these generals, they do want to see Myanmar open up and develop, which is also what Aung San Suu Kyi and most of the people in Myanmar want to see. But at the same time, they are very adamant about defending their strategic autonomy within the political structure of Myanmar currently. So if Aung San Suu Kyi or the NLD are not careful about the issues of constitutional amendments, the military's role in parliament, retribution for what past military regimes have done, the ethnic armed conflict issue, those are the things that the military still feels very strongly about. And if Aung San Suu Kyi is not careful about those issues, you know, getting their consensus, their cooperation, I think we might see a lot of tension. Now, the tension has been there, even as the military said that they would support the new government coming in, and it will always be there. But I think it's a good thing for Myanmar politics now that you no longer have only one power pole, which was the military. Now you have the parliament, you have Aung San Suu Kyi and her party, and then you have the military. So I think the military also will have to learn that they are now just one, you know, power structure within Myanmar politics. But I think they are getting there because they do want to see their country develop.
The military still has significant political power based on the current constitution, which means that reforming it is a thorny issue.
Well, the military, one of the things they insisted on in the midst of the reforms is they would keep 25% of the seats in the two houses of parliament, which mean and any constitutional reform requires 75% of the vote in the houses of parliament, which means that it's with the military, unless some military guys vote with the National League for Democracy, it's almost impossible to do any reforms, constitutional reforms. The biggest one that people are, there's two big reforms that people are looking at. One is what's called 59F that prevents Aung San Suu Kyi from running to serve as president because she has two sons and a now deceased husband who are Brits. The other one is the clause 436, which keeps the military gives the military 25% of the seats in parliament, which prevents the constitutional changes. It's not clear that that's going to change anytime soon. Obviously, it's going to take, I would guess, years of the military giving working together with the National League for Democracy and seeing if they can build enough trust and confidence to change some of these things. Military reform has happened. Military giving up some of its political control has happened elsewhere in Southeast Asia. Indonesia is a prime example of that. So I wouldn't rule it out entirely, but these guys may not give up power easily.
Now, the former ruling party of Myanmar, the Union Solidarity and Development Party, or USDP, is also at a crossroads. Fung says the USDP will likely play the long game following their heavy defeat in the November elections.
I think to sort of see where the USDP is and how it's thinking, we have to go back to the November elections. The USDP was very shocked by its own poor performance because they saw themselves as somebody, an entity that had ushered in an era of reforms in Myanmar, and they had managed to deliver certain concrete outcomes in terms of development, rural development, as well as bringing in foreign investment. And they were shocked that the people did not give them any due credit because of their affiliation with the military. So I think the USDP went through a lot of soul searching after the November elections, and they decided, together with the military, to honor the results of this election, due in part to international scrutiny of what was going on in Myanmar, but also because they realized that Aung San Suu Kyi is fairly old and she hasn't groomed any successors, which means the NLD might face a more uncertain future than the USDP actually does, because the USDP is a well-resourced party and it can pull from their technocrats who worked for the previous government as well as from military ranks. So they saw themselves as an entity that will stay, and the NLD, once Aung San Suu Kyi exits the stage, faces a very uncertain prospect. So I think they decided to play the long game in the politics of Myanmar.
Simmering ethnic divisions and recent conflicts also contribute to the tension in Myanmar. A peace process among ethnic armed groups and the government started by former President Thein Sein is unfinished. Aung San Suu Kyi will have to decide how best to go forward.
Aung San Suu Kyi has never made clear her stance on the peace process that was started under the Thein Sein government. So last October, when the Thein Sein government signed a ceasefire agreement with eight ethnic armed groups, she was believed to be of the mind that the ethnic groups should not have rushed into signing that peace agreement with the government. But later, when the government held a union peace conference with the signatories of the ceasefire, she showed up. She gave an opening speech, and she said that more groups should come in and join the process. So it created some confusion as to where she stands. And I think to understand why she has been acting the way she has been, we have to know that she came into the ethnic conflicts in Myanmar being General Aung San's daughter. So people expect her to come to the table with a second Panglong agreement in which she could bring together all of the ethnic groups of Myanmar, as well as the majority of Bamar, and find a way to bring about federalism and equal power sharing among all groups. And the Panglong Agreement was shortly after Myanmar's independence in 1947, when Aung San met with all of the ethnic groups and asked them to join the union and try out federalism and see if it worked. And if it didn't, then they could decide to leave the union should they choose to. But of course, it never got to be implemented because he was murdered shortly after that. So she has huge political capital. That means she has to not only defend the interests of the Bamar, the majority, which people expect her to do, but people also expect her to satisfy the demands of all of the other ethnic groups. And at the same time, the Tatmadaw, in terms of the ceasefire process, they sort of saw her as, hey, you are the daughter of Aung San, so you have to defend the integration of the union as well. So everybody expects her to represent their interests. And that's very hard for her to come away with a clear-cut stance. And I think what she has done so far is she has been appeasing to the military for a little bit, to the Tian Shan government for a little bit, and to the ethnic groups for a little bit. But it will take her some time to decide for herself, okay, I may want to bring to the table a second Panglong agreement. What form should it take? How should I go about it? How should I handle the military? Because as you know, Tian Shan sort of saw the ceasefire process as his legacy, and that did not always work so well with the military because the generals thought that Tian Shan was at some point too hasty in terms of negotiating with the ethnic groups. And for Aung San Suu Kyi, she, despite all of the pressure, she doesn't have to rush. She has the political capital, and every side wants to court her and wants her to be on their sides. So, you know, that's sort of an interesting dynamics, and we shall see how she will decide to go about it. Now, the ceasefire signatories, they are a little bit divided about how to go forward with this process because the Myanmar Peace Center, a government-backed body that used to handle negotiations with all of the armed groups that sign on to negotiate with the Tian Shan government, has been dissolved. And how she will go about preserving the work, the outcomes, the achievements that they have built, and how she will sort of work with the non-ceasefire signatories remains to be seen. And so far, there's been very little for us to look at, but we shall see.
A separate structural challenge animating the tension in the country is the rise of religious nationalism among Myanmar's Buddhist majority. Religious clashes and discrimination against Muslim minorities are becoming more and more frequent. Murray again.
A virulent form of Buddhist nationalism has emerged under the reforms. The military used to be able to control that more easily, but as they opened up the country, this group called Mabata has emerged. They have introduced all kinds of regulations against Muslims. They've introduced restrictions on women. There is a general feeling, and that we saw in 2012 in particular, a number of uprisings, of clashes between Buddhists and Muslims. In the total, about 200 people died in those clashes. The place that it was probably the most difficult, it was Rakhine State in the far northwest, where there is an ethnic minority that generations ago started migrating from Bangladesh called the Rohingya. And these guys are very discriminated against. That is wildly popular among Buddhists generally in Myanmar. And the government is going to have to try and address this. But it's very difficult for Aung San Suu Kyi, who needs the support of the Burman majority. And so how she does it exactly is not clear. They're going to probably have to continue doing dialogues between Muslims and Buddhists. There's going to have to be, whenever there's a crackdown, whenever there's an uprising, there's going to have to be some way to rein in the Buddhists and Muslims from injuring each other. It's really a tough environment. And it's one that the government can't take on easily. One of the things that, you know, it has been talked about a lot in the international community is trying to deal with the state of Rakhine is one of the second poorest in the country. And one way to build trust and confidence is for the international community to provide assistance for both the poor Rakhine population and the poor Rohingya population, so that when the quality of life improves, there will be less of a fear that one group is stealing the land from the other, and there will be more confidence going forward. But this is a really tough issue for Aung San Suu Kyi and the National League for Democracy to tackle.
Myanmar's future will also depend on how it manages relations with its neighbors. Myanmar's foreign policy toward China, ASEAN, and the United States all will require attention. China's presence looms large, but understanding Myanmar's national identity is essential.
China is one big piece of the puzzle, but I think when you talk about Myanmar's foreign policy, we need to remember the way that the Myanmar people see themselves. They see themselves as being sandwiched between China and India, two of Asia's giant powers, and that's how they see themselves. So foreign policy is everyday life for them, and they need to be very careful about keeping stability as well as balancing both of these rising powers. Now, obviously, China has been a very delicate issue for Myanmar, dating back to the decades of junta rule when the generals did not have anywhere to turn but Beijing. So that created a sort of codependency and a lot of tension, anti-China sentiment on the ground in Myanmar due to what the people saw as economic exploitation of Myanmar as well as China's just growing footprint in the country. You could feel that all across Myanmar in terms of Chinese businesses, Chinese influence, Chinese immigrants coming in. So there's a lot of tension on the ground, especially in the upper part of Myanmar. Now, even under junta rule, despite the dependency, the reliance on Beijing for absolutely everything from political support to food supplies to military equipment, the generals had always been able to maintain independence. And that's, I think, a pretty amazing feat for the military, because that goes to the core of Myanmar's foreign policy of being independent, active, and non-aligned. So it may be the new government handling foreign relations, but I expect them to still follow that path, because that's a path that decides a lot, for Myanmar's foreign policy outlook. So I think Aung San Suu Kyi will follow the orientation of foreign policy being independent, active, and non-aligned. But she also has a chip on her shoulder, because Beijing has been actively courting her, but at the same time, Beijing also sees her as someone who is inherently pro-West, someone who was raised in India, who spent her life in the UK, and who received support from the US and other Western countries through her pro-democracy struggle. So that is the light they saw her, even just coming in, and she'll have to be very careful managing, because as I said, no matter who is in power in Naypyidaw, they want to maintain a balance between China, India, and the West.
With respect to ASEAN, new Foreign Minister Aung San Suu Kyi faces a different challenge. What's the outlook there?
It's interesting that you ask, because ASEAN has been watching the developments in Myanmar very closely, and the decision that Aung San Suu Kyi will serve as foreign minister was very intriguing to a lot of the governments across ASEAN. Most of the governments in ASEAN, they wanted to see change in Myanmar, but they never explicitly show support for Aung San Suu Kyi, and in fact, they prefer dealing with the military government than with her. So it will be very interesting to see her join the circle of ASEAN foreign ministers and sit at the table, and she'll come in with a huge international profile. I don't believe that any other foreign ministers in ASEAN has that profile that she has. So it'll be very interesting, because at the same time that she raises the profile of the group, we'll have to watch whether she sort of sees this grouping as in sort of a friendly light, because there just wasn't a history of engagement between them before.
And of course, U.S. policy has played a role in getting Myanmar to this point. What's next?
I think in regards to U.S.-Myanmar relations, the success of the election, I think we need to give the due credit to the people of Myanmar. But U.S. policy has been very successful because U.S. policymakers were able to determine that this is the desired end goal of our foreign policy toward Myanmar, and put all resources into that, invest into the process, and see that Myanmar could get there with support from the U.S. and other international partners. And I think that's a very important lesson for the U.S. Heading into the next stage, we need to be able to sort of determine what do we want to see next in Myanmar just within the next 3 or 5 year window. The goal shouldn't be too lofty. It should help the new governments deliver on the expectations that the people had for Aung San Suu Kyi when they voted for her party. So, yes, I mean, we can talk about remaining sanctions and how that affects business. But at the same time, you want to think of the policy objectives that Washington can achieve, let's say, within the next 3 or 5 years, and not necessarily, oh, we have to lift sanctions because that will solve everything. The U.S. was able to help Myanmar get to this point with while still keeping sanctions on because we had a clear objective in mind and we knew how to go about using the resources. So I think, yes, the question of sanctions and how do you remove the people currently on the specially designated nationals list will be important, but that's more of a long-term question. The more pressing question right now is Washington needs to decide what it wants to see in Myanmar within the next 5 years and work towards that goal.
As the face of Myanmar and the leader of the new government, Aung San Suu Kyi will have a tremendous burden of responsibilities. Juggling so many portfolios and challenges while governing will no doubt be difficult, but no reason not to be optimistic.
I think at first when the new government came into office, it was announced that she would play 4 ministerial posts: Minister of Foreign Affairs, Minister of Education, Minister of Energy and Electricity, and Minister in the President's Office. And this went hand in hand with her statement that she will rule above the President and it will be her who makes all the decisions. But shortly after, we saw that her party pushed through Parliament a bill that would make her state councillor, meaning she could use all of the resources afforded her by the government to take meetings, to make decisions, not make decisions, but give advice to the government and go about policy formulation and implementation however she sees fit. And after that, I think overnight, over the weekend, we saw the new government coming out and announced that there will be other people who would oversee the portfolios of education and energy and electricity. That means that going into the new government, she will likely play the role of foreign affairs minister, minister in the president's office, and state counselor. And I think that would be more manageable. And she will be both the inside and the outside face of Myanmar without taking on too much. And I think she will try to manage it. We all know that she works very hard. And the NLD lawmakers, they might not have a lot of governance experience, but they also work very hard. And I think we need to give them the credit that all of them are coming into this new landscape with a clear-eyed view of where Myanmar is, what the challenges are, what they're up against, but they also have the right mindset. The decision to slash a lot of the ministerial portfolios coming in from 30-something over 30 to 22, as well as to cut a lot of the redundancy in budget allocations within the system, sort of tells you that they know the challenges they're up against and they need to use their resources wisely. So I think I am optimistic about the prospect of the new government. They have the right mindset. We'll see if they'll go about it the right way as well.
Murray Hebert agrees. He points out that Suu Kyi and the NLD will need the ability to delegate and must be given time to move Myanmar forward.
So she, as you said, she's really got a lot of responsibilities. She's the de facto foreign minister, education minister, energy, environment, and a minister in the president's office, which mean really is the a very key sort of chief of staff kind of position. It's really physically impossible for one person to do all those jobs. She will have to find a way to appoint talented, trusted deputies in all these ministries, but how does she do just the meetings and the number of guests that are going to come through, foreign donors that are going to come through, people coming from states complaining about services? How is she going to be able to do that? That's humanly impossible. We don't know yet how good of a leader she can be. This is her first time. She's 70 years old. This is the first time she's running something besides her party, which she did with considerable talent. But she was in house arrest for 15 years. Her source of information was really the BBC. She was cut off living in house arrest. So how she will manage and come up with the ideas necessary is a real challenge. And as we've already said, her party also is filled with a lot of people who spent time, decades in prison and haven't had experience running anything. So I think there's a lot of expectations in the country. I've been there twice recently since the elections, and boy, the expectations are sky high. People think she will solve every problem before dawn tomorrow. It's kind of unrealistic, but I think the international community is also going to have to give her a little bit of space on the ethnic conflict, on the treatment of Muslims, on economic development, and these challenges. We can't expect her and the country to fix all these problems, not only tomorrow, not only in the next year or two. It's going to need a couple of terms, presidential terms of 5 years to fix these problems. Rome wasn't built in a night and overnight, and neither is Myanmar going to be built overnight.
At CSIS, we'll be watching to see whether the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi can translate electoral victory into successful governance in the face of so many complex problems and high expectations. And with that, we've reached the end of our show. Thanks to Murray Hebert and Feng Nguyen of the CSIS Chair for Southeast Asia Studies for their insights. Thanks also to Lauren Abu-Ali, who edited the podcast, and to Jeff Bean, who wrote and produced it. For more on all things Asia, you can visit our dedicated site, cogitasia.com, or go to csis.org. I'm Colm Quinn. Thanks for listening.